Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Our Torah portion today is Chayesera. Chayesera is Genesis chapter 23 through most chapter 25. Sarah's lifetime was 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years, the years of Sarah's life. Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, which is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to eulogize Sarah and to weep for her. Abraham rose up the presence of his dead and spoke to the children of Het, saying, I am an alien and a resident among you. Grant me an estate for a burial site with you, that I may bury my dead from before me. The children of Het answered Abraham, saying to him, Hear us, my lord. You are a prince of God in our midst. In the choicest of our burial places, bury your dead. Any one of us will not withhold his burial place from you, from burying your dead. Then Abraham arose up and bowed down the members of the council, the children of Het. He spoke to them, saying, If it is truly your will to bury my dead from before me, heed me, intercede for me with Ephron, son of Zor. Let him grant me the cave of Machpelah, which is his. On the edge of his field, let him grant it to me for its full price. In your midst as an estate for a burial site. Now Ephron was sitting in the midst of the children of Het, and Ephron the Hittite responded to Abraham in the hearing of the children of Het, for all who come to the gate of the city, saying, No, my lord, heed me, I have given you the field. As for the cave that is in it, I have given it to you. In the view of the children of my people, I have given it to you. Bury your dead. So Abraham bowed down before the members of the council. He spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the members of the council, saying, Rather, if only you would heed me, I give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there. And Ephron replied to Abraham, saying, My lord, heed me. Land worth 400 silver shekels between me and you. What is it? Bury your dead. Abraham heeded Ephron, and Abraham weighed out to Ephron the price which he had mentioned in the hearing of the children of Het, 400 silver shekels in negotiable currency. In Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, facing Mamre, the field and the cave within it, and all the trees in the field within all its surrounding boundaries, was confirmed as Abraham's, as a purchase the view of the children of Het, among all who came to the gate of this city. And afterwards, Abraham buried Sarah his wife in the cave of the field of Machpelah, facing Mamre, which is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Thus the field with the cave that was in it was confirmed as Abraham's, as an estate for a burial site from the children of Het. Chapter 24. Now Abraham was old, well on in years, and Jehovah blessed Abraham with everything. And Abraham said to his servant, to the elder of his household who controlled all that was his, Place now your hand under my thigh, and I will have you swear by Jehovah, God of heaven and God of earth, that you not take a wife for my son, the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell. Rather, to my land, to my kindred, shall you go and take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said to him, Perhaps the woman shall not wish to follow me to this land. Shall I take your son back to the land from which you departed? Abraham answered him, Beware not to return my son to there. Jehovah, God of heaven, who took me from the house of my father and from the land of my birth, who spoke concerning me and who swore to me, saying, To your offspring I will give this land, he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman will not wish to follow you, you shall then be absolved of this oath of mine. However, do not return my son to there. So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him regarding this matter. Then the servant took 10 camels of his master's camels and set out with all the bounty of his master in his hand and made his way to Aram Naharim, the city of Nahor. He made the camels kneel down outside the city towards a well of water at evening time, the time when the women come to draw water out. He said, "Jehovah, God of my master Abraham, may you so arrange it for me this day that you do kindness with my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing here by the spring, the water, the daughters of the townsmen come out to draw water. Let it be the maiden whom I shall say, 'Please tip over your jug so I may drink.' And he replies, 'Drink, and I will even water your camels.' Her will you have designated for your servant, for Isaac. And may I know through her that you have done kindness with my master." And it was when he had not yet finished speaking that suddenly Rebekah was coming out. She who had been born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, brother to Abraham, with her jug upon her shoulder. Now the maiden was very fair to look upon, a virgin whom no man had known. She descended to the spring, filled her jug, and ascended. The servant ran towards her and said, "Let me sip, if you please, a little water from your jug." She said, "Drink, my lord." And quickly she lowered her jug to her hand and gave him to drink. When she finished giving him to drink, she said, "I will draw water even for your camels until they have finished drinking." So she hurried and emptied her jug into the trough and kept running to the well to draw water. And she drew for all his camels. The man was astonished at her, reflecting silently to know whether Jehovah had made his journey successful or not. And it was, when the camels had finished drinking, the man took a golden nose ring, its weight was a beka, and two bracelets on her arms. 10 gold shekels was their weight. He said to her, "Whose daughter are you? Pray, tell me, is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." And she said to him, "Even straw and feed is plentiful with us, as well as a place to lodge." So the man bowed low and prostrated himself to Jehovah. He said, "Blessed is Jehovah, God of my master Abraham, who has not withheld his kindness and truth for my master. As for me, Jehovah has guided me on the way to the house of my father's brothers." The maiden ran and told her mother's household according to these events. Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. Laban ran to the man outside the spring, for upon seeing the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's hands, and upon the hearing of his sister Rebekah's words, saying, "Thus has the man spoken to me," he approached the man who was still standing by the camels by the spring. He said, "Come, O blessed Jehovah, why should you stand outside when I have cleared the house and replaced the camels?" So the man entered the house and unmuzzled the camels. He gave straw and feed the camels and water to bathe his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. Food was set before him, but he said, "I will not eat until I have spoken my piece." And he said, "Speak." Then he said, "A servant of Abraham am I. Jehovah has greatly blessed my master, and he has prospered. He has given him flocks and cattle, silver and gold, servants and maidservants, camels and donkeys. Sarah, my master's wife, bore my master a son after she had grown old, and he gave him all that he possesses. And my master had me take an oath, saying, 'Do not take a wife for my son among the daughters of the Canaanites, in whose land I dwell, unless you go to my father's house and to my family and take a wife for my son.' I said to my master, 'Perhaps one will not follow me.' He replied to me, 'Jehovah, before whom I have walked, will send his angel with you and make your journey successful, and you shall take a wife for my son, my family, and my father's house. Then will you be absolved from my oath when you have come to my family. And if they will not give her to you, then you shall be absolved from my oath. I came today by the spring and said, 'Jehovah, God of my master Abraham, if you would graciously make successful the way on which I go, behold, I am standing by the spring of water. Let it be the young woman who comes out to draw and whom I shall say, "Please give me some water to drink from your jug," and who will answer me, "You may also drink, and I will draw water for your camels too. She shall be the woman whom Jehovah designated for my master's son." And I had not yet finished meditating when suddenly Rebekah came out with a jug on her shoulder and descended to the spring and drew water. So I said to her, please give me a drink. And she hurried and lowered her jug upon herself and said, drink, and I will even water your camels. So I drank, and she watered the camels also. Then I questioned her and said, whose daughter are you? And she said, the daughter of Bethuel, son of Nahor, whom Milcah bore to him. And I placed the ring on her nose, the bracelet upon her hands. And I bowed and prostrated myself to Jehovah and blessed Jehovah, God of my master, Abraham, who led me on a true path to take the daughter of my master's brother for his son. And now if you will intend to do kindness and truth with my master, tell me. And if not, tell me. I will turn to the right or to the left. Then the bond of Bethuel answered and said, the matter stemmed from Jehovah. We can say to you neither good nor bad. Here, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go. Let her be a wife to your master's son, as Jehovah has spoken. And it was when Abraham's servant heard their words, he prostrated himself to the ground unto Jehovah, and the servant brought out objects of silver and gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah and delicious fruits, and he gave to her brother and her mother. They ate and they drank, he and the men who were with him, and they spent the night. When they arose the next morning, he said, send me to my master. Her brother and mother said, let the maiden remain with us a year or 10 months. Then she will go. He said to them, do not delay me now that Jehovah had made my journey successful. Send me, and I will go to my master. They said, well, let us call the maiden and ask her decision. They called Rebekah and said to her, will you go with this man? And she said, I will go. So they escorted Rebekah, their sister, and her nurse, as well as Abraham's servant and his men. They blessed Rebekah and said to her, our sister, may you come to be thousands of myriads, and may your offspring inherit the gates of its enemies. And Rebekah arose with her maidens, and they rode upon the camels and proceeded after the man. The servant took Rebekah and went. Now Isaac came from having gone to Beer-chad Leroi, and for he dwelt in the south country. Isaac went out to supplicate in the field towards evening, and he raised his eyes and saw, behold, camels were coming. Rebekah raised her eyes and saw Isaac. She inclined while upon the camel, and said to the servant, who is that man walking in the field towards us? The servant said, he is my master. She then took the veil and covered herself, and the servant told Isaac all things he had done. Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah's mother. He married Rebekah, she became his wife, and he loved her. And thus was Isaac consoled after his mother. Chapter 5. Abraham proceeded and took a wife whose name was Keturah. She bore to him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuah. Jokshan begot Sheba and Dedan, and the children of Dedan were Asherim, Letushim, and Lumim. The children of Midian, Ephah, Epher, Hanoch, Abida, and Elda. These were the descendants of Keturah. Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but to the concubines' children, who were Abraham's, Abraham gave gifts. Then he sent them away from Isaac his son, while he was still alive, eastward to the land of the east. These the days, the years of Abraham's life, which he lived, 170 years and 5 years. And Abraham expired and died at a good old age, mature and content. He was gathered to his people. His sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zor, the Hittite, facing Mamre, the field that Abraham had bought from the children of Het. There Abraham was buried, and Sarah, his wife. It was after the death of Abraham that God blessed Isaac, his son, and Isaac settled near Beer Lahoroi. These are the sons of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar, the Egyptian, Sarah's maidservant, had bore to Abraham. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names in order of their birth. Ishmael's first, Nebaiot, Kedar, Abiel, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Massa, Hadad, Timah, Jetur, Nephish, Kedem. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their open cities and by their strongholds, 12 chieftains for their nations. These are the years of Ishmael's life, 137 years, when he expired and died, and was gathered to his people. They dwelt from Havilah to Shur, which is near Egypt, toward Assyria. Over all his brothers he dwelt. That was a Torah portion. That was Genesis chapter 23, 24, and the first half or so of chapter 25. It covers a bunch of topics, obviously the life of Sarah and such, and life of Abraham, a bit of Isaac. Any comments or questions regarding my before I go into my spiel about what I want to share with you today, any comments or questions or issues you had regarding this Torah portion, things that didn't quite make sense to you, or things you have any questions about, because I may not get to those topics if you don't ask them now. Well, that was easy. All right, this will be quick. So, oops, don't lose my notebook. Got to get my notes straight. Chayasera. All right. So, in this story portion, obviously we covered it starts at chapter 23, which is the life of Sarah, or actually more accurately speaking, the death of Sarah. Yeah, she died fairly old. Now, granted, she's one of the few women whose life span, how old they were, is actually recorded. I think she's the only one who actually has their age recorded in the Tanakh. I could be wrong. There might be somebody else, but as far as I know, that's it. But when she had passed away, there's a few things we're going to cover. There's three separate topics we're going to talk about today regarding the Torah portion. There's a Torah portion which has a few things into it. We're going to compare that or contrast that to something the Messiah had done when he dealt with a similar situation. Similar is a loose word there, but another situation that has some similarities to it. We're also covering a third topic. We have time for that in the Hof Torah portion. All three of these are related in different ways. They cover different types of topics. The first one, which we're going to compare, has a detail with Messiah and what he dealt with in the type of conversation he had and Eleazar with his conversation with Rebecca, and explain a little bit of details of what God's trying to teach us regarding these two conversations. But before we get there, there's a few details you should know about this Torah portion before we get to the topics of the actual people themselves. Okay. Abraham, of course, his wife dies, right? So he goes to the children of Het. Now, the children of Het, it is commonly argued, you can't prove this, by the way, that the Hittite Empire, these children of Het, were descendants of the Hittite Empire. The Hittite Empire, of course, those of you who are not aware of them, they were the Asia Minor territory, for a little bit north of Damascus, from that period north into the Eurasia territory, where they conquered and ruled. Hittite Empire was fairly strong up through this point, was fairly strong, and it stayed a large empire. And it dominated a lot of influence in that territory, which we would consider today is mostly of the area of Turkey and parts of the northern parts of the Assyrian Empire. They wound up becoming a defunct, wiped out people groups about 500 years later after this topic, but almost 600 years later. But this empire at this time is fairly strong still in Abraham's territory. And they were feared because their dominant power weapon was they invented what we call chariots. The Hittites invented them. No one knew what they were, no one had what they could do anything with them, but they designed and built what we call chariots. And that's, we understand who they are because we have records of their design and how they brought the design and sold the design to the Egyptians when they fought Egypt. Actually, sold is not the right word. They defeated Egyptians. Just picked up the dead bodies and found some chariots and copied it. That's more accurate what happened. So the Egyptians wound up coming in chariots too, but that's the nature of how these... So these people are fairly powerful and fairly strong, well-defended, well-armored individuals. Abraham, this is very important to understand. Where does Abraham live? Or Canaan?
Canaanites.
Who are the Canaanites?
The sons of Cain.
The sons of Cain. The Canaanites have a whole bunch of different people grouped together. It's not one people, it's a bunch of people. And they're all from different descendancies, different groups, different associations. So we'll write it up here. It's kind of like a melting pot. They have their various explanations and such. I'm going to go through. I keep losing that. I should bolt it down or something. All right. Different markers. Oh, so Canaanites. Of course, our Torah gives us different examples of different people that were listed. You have, of course, as it discussed, the Canaanites, which include meaning they are people who dwell with them, not necessarily biological relatives, though some of them are, but people who dwell with them. Your Bible obviously lists the different people groups, the Girgashites. I'm going to abbreviate, forgive me. The Jebusites. And you have Hittites are included. And you have, let's see, who else? You have, what are the other lists? Amor, yes, Amorites. There's a few. Yeah, Perizzites. Now, Perizzites and Girgashites are a unique group. I misspelled some of these, I'm sure. But it doesn't matter. I'm not going to list every group. But most of these are descendants of the people of Cain, or that grouping. There are distinct exceptions. These groups are notable. These are not the same as you read the list. We read the list of chapter 25 of the sons of Ishmael. So Ishmael has a totally different group of people. All right? Who are Ishmael's descendants? That's listed in chapter 25. And lists all of them, but there's quite a few. Now Ishmael's descendants, of course, obviously Nibal to Kedar and Mishbim, all these different individuals, Masahadad, Tumur, and Nashfish, Kadim. Most of these men that were his sons wound up being grouped together as dominantly one or two nations. They kind of grouped together, stayed as a huddled group. But that is not the same as Abraham's descendants. So Ishmael has descendants that are independent, as well as Abraham has descendants. So all these things are not necessarily the same groups of people, but they all have similar outcomes for various reasons. So in Ishmael's descendancy, the people who wound up being called Ishmaelites, Kedar was a dominant one. Kedarim is still they're not around today, but they show up for quite a while. And the other one was Masan Hadad. Oops, that's an A. Those are three dominant descendants of Ishmael who wind up dominating the rest of them. And then you have Abraham's descendants and others, which is the ones that become the dominant ones, is Midian and was the last one? There were two of them became dominant. Midian was a dominant one. I think it was, I've forgotten. Is it Midian or, I forgot the other guy. Midian and one of the other ones. I forgot which one was the dominant one. Midian is one of his other descendants we also become similar to, as far as how they become dominant. These characters, Abraham's descendants, did not dwell in the land of Canaan, but they still had influence. They were nearby, right? These is over here for Canaan. They dwelled there. I bring this whole point up because God winds up explaining to Abraham, we went back to this back in Genesis chapter 15, what was God's objective when he talked to Abraham about the inheritance? He said, it's not yet, because the Amorites' iniquity was not yet complete. He had to wait 400 years before it's complete. So God had pre-explained to Abraham, there is a particular list or whatever God's writing down of saying, I'm waiting for this list to complete of the tasks or the identities of these things that these individuals are doing or what their activities are before I say it's time to expel them. Now we've talked about this before. When we went over Sodom and Gomorrah, there is a judgment that God makes about a group of people, which we ourselves can't make. I can't tell whether any one of you or vice versa, you can tell of me, what inside me is teachable, meaning fixable, and what's not. But God determines what is and isn't fixable on a given person or group of people. Now we learn when he dealt with Sodom and Gomorrah, God had determined that the people of those towns could not be taught out of their ways. Therefore, the solution, God said, was remove them. Now, clearly, he did not make that decision for all peoples. He isolated Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding area, that those people who live there, there's a behavior or an activity they do, or activities, or behaviors, plural, that cannot be educated out of them. Note, we talked at the time, it did not include any one crime, any one thing. It was many things that God said, God made the determination, they cannot be taught out of them. Now, in the case when it comes to the Canaanites, God points out to Abraham, this is 400 years, 100 years before it happens, that the Amorites, means all the rest of their lists, are being written down for their task, what is expellable, what has to be done. But eventually, all of these individuals, their list will be complete. And God said, now it's time to remove them. I can't speak what God will do. I'm only going to say what he said. I'm not going to project what he's going to do in the future. I'm not going to argue that question. So, to remove them, now he removes them in a number of different ways. He kills off some, exterminates, but most, they flee. But a number of them stay. And the Israelites choose to not remove them. So we have this category of individuals God determines cannot be taught out of their conduct. That's a hard place to be. We as believers in Messiah say, well, how can you possibly say there's a sin too great? Is there a sin too great for God to forgive? No. We're not discussing that. There is a cultural problem that God says the culture is too severe. The culture cannot be forgiven, cannot be taught out of it. We're not discussing individual humans, by the way. We're discussing a group of people. I say that very importantly, because don't forget that. Sodom and Gomorrah were not individual humans. It was a group of cities. An organized group of cities who, as a conduct or behavior, as it records when they were destroyed, chose to affect or assault or attack guests of some way. Now we could argue what all those ways happened to be. That was their decision as a people group. And that's when God said, you cannot be taught out of this. You've institutionalized this method. You've institutionalized this technique, this status, this method of doing their healing with other, dealing with other people. That can't be fixed as far as God was concerned. So it's better off to end you now before it gets worse. And I'm not going to guess what the worst is. And honestly, I can't tell you for truth or for honesty what all they did. It doesn't record. And it's probably wise that it doesn't. Because what would humans do if they did record it? We would duplicate it. That's what humans do. We say, wow, that's an interesting idea. And guess what? We go down there. That's what humans do because we can become curious. So it's wisest for us not to have a full record of what they do. But we do have a record of what these individuals do. That's recorded in Leviticus chapter 20. Leviticus 20 records why God is expelling these group of people for their behaviors, what they're doing. I'll read that now before I go off to another topic. So just Leviticus 20, just so we understand the nature of the people, this is the primary reason why Abraham tells his servant, do not choose a wife among these people for my son Isaac. Leviticus 20, we read this just so we understand the nature of what Abraham is not pleased with and some people he lives amongst and their conduct. Now, I realize that this may not be a simple task or how it's abhorrent to our way of life, the conduct being listed here, but it's enough to realize that, okay, God is saying this is how bad these people are living. And this is what I cannot tolerate amongst this group of people. Now, we're not listing that amongst the Ishmaelites' descendants or Abraham's other children. This is just Isaac and the Canaanites in particular. All right? So don't mix them up. Leviticus 20, This is, of course, God speaking to Moses and the various conducts of the land which they are going to possess, which is the land of Canaanites, where Abraham's currently living in our Torah portion. Leviticus 20, it says, Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, say to the children of Israel, any man of the children of Israel and from the proselyte who lives within Israel, who shall give his seed to Molech, shall put to death. The people of the land shall pelt him with stones. Stop there for a minute. Giving your seed to Molech means human offering your child up to the god of Molech while it's still alive. So you're burning your child alive in this furnace, right? Verse 3, I shall concentrate my attention upon that man. I shall cut him off from among his people. For he had given his offspring to Molech in order to defile my sanctuary and desecrate my holy name. If the people of the land avert their eyes from that man when he gives from his offspring to Molech, to not put him to death, then I shall concentrate my attention upon that man and upon his family. I will cut off from among their people him and all who stray after him to stray after Molech. And the person who shall turn the sorcery of Oz and the Edonim to stray after them, I shall concentrate my attention upon that person, cut him off among his people. So we have not just the individual offering their child, but God also holds those who are watching and aware of it equally as responsible. I will hold him accountable, as well as his family who knows about it, and all those who are watching it, they're all equally accountable. God will hold them all according to it. Verse 7 says, you shall sanctify yourselves, you shall be holy, for I am Jehovah your God who is holy. You shall observe my decrees, perform them. I am Jehovah who sanctifies you. For any man who will curse his father and mother shall be put to death. His father, his mother, he is cursed, his blood is upon himself. Any man who will commit adultery with a man's wife, who will commit adultery with his fellow's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall be put to death. A man who shall lie with his father's wife will have uncovered his father's shame. The two of them shall be put to death. Their blood's upon themselves. A man who lies with his daughter-in-law, the two of them shall be put to death, but they have committed perversion. Their blood's upon themselves. A man who lies with the man as one lies with the woman, they shall have done an abomination, put to death. Their blood's upon themselves. A man who shall take a woman from a mother, take a woman and her mother, is a depraved plot. They shall burn him, and them in fire, and they shall not be depraving. There shall be depravity among you. Man shall lie with an animal shall put to death, and you shall kill the animal. A woman who approaches the animal for it to mate with her, you shall kill the woman of the animal. They shall put to death. Their blood is upon them. Man shall take his sister, the daughter of his father and mother, or of the daughter of his mother. He shall see your nakedness. She shall see his nakedness. It is a disgrace. They're cut off in the sight of the members of their family. He will uncover the nakedness of his sister. He shall bear his own iniquity. A man who lies with a woman in her affliction, uncovered her nakedness, he will have bared her source, and she has bared the source of her blood. Two of them shall be cut off from the midst of the people. The nakedness of your mother's sister or your father's sister shall not uncover. That's bearing one's own flesh. They shall bear their iniquity. A man who shall lie with his aunt will uncover the nakedness of his uncle. They shall bear their sin. They shall be died childless. A man who shall take his brother's wife, it is loathsome. He shall uncover his brother's shame. They shall be childless. You shall observe my decrees, my ordinance, perform them in the land which I bring you to dwell. Do not disgorge yourselves. Do not follow the traditions of the nation that I expel from before you. For they did all these things, and I was disgusted with them. So I said to you, you shall inherit their land. I will give it to you to inherit, a land full of milk and honey. I am Jehovah, your God, who has separated you from the peoples. So we have a list of an example that God's pointing out. All these things, that most of those in our culture are abhorrent. I realize that some of them are acceptable in our culture. I'm not going to argue every acceptable way. But the point is, most of them are abhorrent to us, even today. And that this is the conduct that God is recording of unacceptable behavior. These are lists of God saying, this group of people, the Canaanites who I'm expelling, that's what the conduct he's measuring, what he's weighing, saying this must not be done. The offering of children, being complicit in that offering, the various relationships between related people that should not be done, and it is an acceptable behavior, that's what he's expelling. And I can only imagine that if this is what God's threshold of measurement for Canaan was, I don't know what Sodom was doing. All right, this is God led Canaan, so we'll let this 400 years to go on before he's talking to Abraham. 400 more years to let this happen. Sodom said, that's enough. We're done. We're ending now. So whatever they were doing was worse than all this. I'm not sure what all it was, and I don't want to go any much deeper than that, but God pointed out that Sodom and Gomorrah, you're worse than this list in Leviticus 20. You cannot be tolerated to survive any further. We ask ourselves, why is that? Well, I have a simple question for you. Does good corrupt evil, or does evil corrupt good? So what happens when wickedness grows? It spreads. As Isaiah said, wickedness spreads like wildfire. It continues to grow and grows very quickly. That's what wickedness does. So God saw a source of a serious problem. End it now, because the problem is going to spread too quickly, and time isn't right yet. So end it now. So this is the nature of the people who Abraham is living amongst. He's told his tells his servant Eleazar, do not choose a woman from amongst these people. Why is that? Well, can't she just be taught to not act this way? Can't she just be taught, you were raised this way, but to end this process? Well, we think maybe. But what did God tell the descendants with Moses? These people will pollute you. They will drive you and pull you away from what is actually right over time. It's not an instantaneous event. It's over time. It adds over time. It progressively gets further and further and further. That's how evil grows. It's not an instantaneous sprout. It's fully grown tree. It incrementally grows. And you don't notice it. Oh, I'll get to it next week. Well, eventually the roots get a little deeper. Ever pull a weed? And you waited too long? Crud. I pulled it, but it came back. I can't get it out. Next year, it got bigger and bigger because I waited too long. So the same process. Evil goes the same way. It starts little and keeps growing. And then it gets so big and so deep-rooted, you can't just rip it out. It requires a lot to do so. Same principle. All right. Now we come to the basis of what's going on in the cultural war, so to speak, between Abraham and the people he lived with. We jump forward about a few more details. One of the things I want to point out to you is that though Abraham may live in this territory, there's a characteristic trait that he has, which is, I would argue, not unique, but still a characteristic trait. He cares about where he lives. He cares about it. Most of us here live in the United States. We've lived here, born and raised, most of us, right? Well, do you care about the land you live in? Yeah, you do. Do you pray for it? Why is that? Why do you pray for it?
I don't want evil to grow.
You don't want evil to grow. And there's an explanation, which obviously we already know this, but I'll read it to you anyway. Jeremiah 29 gives the example of what God is instructing us to do. Regardless of the nature of the land we live in, whether it be here, whether it be somewhere else, it doesn't really matter. The nature that we live in, there's an instruction he gives to us. Now, this is I'm jumping into the middle of a long conversation that Jeremiah is writing down in his instructions for the people who are being expelled and going off to new land, which they're not familiar with. In Jeremiah 29, it records something. It says, excuse me, starting to verse 4, by the way, like I said, this I'm jumping in the middle of an instruction. So the instruction is actually very elaborate, but I'm covering just a small portion of it. Jeremiah 29, verse 4, it says, thus says Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, to all who were carried away captive, whom I have caused to be carried away from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses, dwell in them, plant gardens, and eat their fruit. Take wives and beget sons and daughters, and take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands, so they may bear sons and daughters, that you may be increased there and not diminished. Seek the peace of the city where I have caused you to be carried away captive, and pray to Jehovah for it, for in its peace you will have peace. So what is the instruction? Regardless of the nature of the nation around us, the conduct we say is acceptable versus not acceptable, whether or not we understand that completely or not, doesn't make a difference. If we don't, wherever we're living, it is in our best interest to seek its peace, to seek its success. Why? Because then we have peace. Your peace is dependent upon God. But God chooses what nation to have his peace and covering on, doesn't he? If he chooses to remove his covering of peace, what happens? The nation falls. So do you who live there. They say, oh, well, but God will protect me. Yes, but that doesn't mean you won't die. You may be protected, but that doesn't mean you don't die through it. You can still die. Things still happen. Designed that way. So it is in your best interest, regardless of the nation, the nature of its conduct, to always pray for it, that you will have peace and protection too. So even though Abraham lives here in the Canaanites, it is still in his interest to pray for them or be blessed them, not necessarily through the, may God you grant some major blessing upon you, but the territory he lives and their peace. I bring that up because Abraham is living amongst near the Hittite area of the Hittites to the control of Canaanite territory, a small section of it, and he has already made alliances with them, military alliances. So even though their conduct is amongst this depraved nature, he still makes an alliance with them, saying, well, it's in our best interest to help each other out. Even though we disagree on virtually every philosophical belief, it's in our best interest to work with each other and cooperate. Because if any one of us stand alone, that person will die. They won't survive. Because nation and life is not so simple and easy. Indoor plumbing has not been invented yet. It's not my personal preference, indoor plumbing. Okay. Let's see here. So, of course, Abraham pays the full price. Now, this is verse 9, of course, the full price. Now, you note that Abraham, of course, recalls this as a gift for the territory, land he's buying for Sarah to be buried in. He calls it a gift, even though it's a full price of 400 silver shekels. Now, we can debate whether that was expensive or cheap. Modern-day standards, that is, no pun intended, dirt cheap, because you could never buy a land this size for 100 grand. You couldn't do it. even in Israel, you still couldn't do it. Not this size of territory, which is allocated for it. It's quite a few acres. But at his time, that was very pricey. So at that time, land was cheaper than that. And we have examples, of course, with Jeremiah when he buys a somewhat similar size field, like 1,000 years later, it'll cost him 17 shekels. Versus 400. So we have a comparable, okay, it is very pricey for Abraham's time period of what he was buying compared to what it really would necessarily be worth then, even though today that was very, very cheap. We also have the example, of course, even with Judas, with his, the 30 shekels like he had earned, they bought a similar size field at his time, Messiah's time, being 30 shekels, which is, you know, that's inflation. Jeremiah did there. Double price, but it's still not even close what Abraham paid. Either way, Abraham did not haggle. Of course, he paid the full price without complaint. Once he has this territory, a permanent place. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Now, I was thinking when that conversation was taking place, it always sounds like the guy is saying, no, you can have it for free. You can have it for free. But then he says, what's 400 shekels between friends?
Right.
And I figured that was their negotiation. He was saying, I want 400 shekels for that land, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a negotiation technique. This is an extreme example, but typically if you notice how Abraham negotiated with God, with the number of people to save for Sodom and Gomorrah, he said, what are those, 50? Okay, about 45. Would you knock them off? It was only 30. He quite worked his way down a little bit, working God's negotiations. Abraham's technique of negotiating skills was very good. He did it with the creator of heaven and earth. Okay. Clearly the man can negotiate and do a pretty good job. Moses did a similar negotiation technique of saying, hey, you kill them, kill me too. There's no point to it. God says, okay, fine. So God, these two men, two examples, we have people who haggled with God. And I could say, you could argue one, sort of one. God had a preset, but the nature of the individual is being revealed in both Abraham and how he would negotiate with God with Sodom and Gomorrah, and of course how Moses negotiated with God when it came to the destruction of the people that came out of Egypt. Now Abraham's haggling skills was perfectly well done, well developed, hence he's very wealthy, but he didn't haggle this time. He chose not to. And I imagine, in my personal opinion, this is my personal opinion, Abraham's sense of mourning was too great. Is not in a mood to quibble. And it doesn't matter the price tag. That is my personal opinion. We can debate what that necessarily was or wasn't. But that's my opinion. So, move forward here. We have, now that he has a territory he spent money and bought and now owns, is now officially his. He's no longer a wanderer. Note, he had noted when he talked to the sons of Het, I am an alien, a wandering person. I don't actually live here. I'm living here, but it's on borrowed land. It's not really mine. Well, this guy, now he's saying, I'm no longer a wanderer. I actually have a physical place as officially my possession. I don't know how the sons of Het got the possession to begin with. They have fought it in a war, who knows? But either way, they owned it, and now Abraham bought it from them at a reasonably high price. So he should argue the high price. Now that he has done that, now, of course, he says, okay, now I need to find a wife for my son. Now, as we already discussed, he was going to avoid these individuals for the various conduct that Abraham saw was abhorrent to him and his life way of life. He sends his servant off, and yes, the servant swears, of course, makes an oath to do so, and of course goes off, and we read the story regarding Rebecca. I have a question for you. It takes a number of weeks to travel from Hebron territory where Abraham's at back to where the Nahor and his family were. Do you think the servant thought about what he was going to do? Probably, right? If he thought about what he was doing, what kind of person do you think the servant was looking for or decided he was looking for? Now, mind you, the servant was from Damascus. He was born and raised in Damascus, which is not that far from Canaan. It's outside the land of Canaan, by the way. It's outside the territory. So his family line was not a part of the Canaanite territory, their conduct. He didn't live that way. But he was aware of them, and he knew the kind of persons, women at least, that were available in the Canaanite territory. But he knew his master didn't want those individuals. So what kind of woman was he looking for? One probably like Sarah, whom his master liked, was very similar in nature, and one who wasn't like any of these people, right? The character traits, he was saying, these are the people that my master does not tolerate, does not want, and his master did not say go to Egypt to find a wife. See, the Egyptian culture was not acceptable to Abraham's master, to his master Abraham. But the kind of woman he was looking for was a different natured woman, one that was unlike the women that he knew. Even probably his own wife, I mean, Eliezer's own wife, who would have been born and raised in similar territory. Rebecca did. So if Eliezer had created a scenario in his head, this is what I'm going to do. This is how I'm going to try to figure this out. Now, I'm sure he thought about it ahead of time. Now, I'm not saying he shot every detail up, but as far as the kind of person he was looking for, who were they? But on the outside, you can't tell a person's insides. So you're looking at them, you can't tell if they're good or bad or evil. It doesn't make a difference, regardless of what they look like. So he has to figure this out ahead of time. Of course, he obviously prays to God and say, what do I do? Now, this is where I want to make a point. You could argue it's important or not, but I think it's important. His threshold of saying acceptable and not acceptable has nothing to do with the religious practices of the time. So don't make it mixed up. So it's important that we understand the Canaanites were all idol worshipers. So was Abraham's family. So idol worship was not a measurement tool. He said, oh, idol worshiper, get rid of. That wasn't the case. So we understand that the religious nature was not what he was looking for. He's looking for a character trait, not a philosophical nature, way of life, but a character trait he was searching for. That's a key thing to remember, that what he's looking for is not a philosophical belief or an idea or concept of who God is or isn't. What religion she was raised in, that is not his measurement tool. Measurement tool is what kind of person is she inside, what the character itself that he's looking for. So, of course, obviously, he's looking for a person that's different than the people who he lives with. Let's see here. Jump down to the test. So, of course, he draws this component. Now, if we look at the nature of the question regarding the whole, give me a drink, he offers a drink, of course, the camels. What character traits, plural, does that reflect or show to the observer? Generous, that's a character trait. Any character trait you can think of? Service, what is it? Hospitality, that's a character trait. Good to the animals, too, is a kindness. Did she know who this man was?
No.
You think she knew him? Maybe. Possibly. Now, she is a relatively young lady. We don't know her exact age, but she's not in her 50s and 60s, most likely. She's probably in her, I'm guessing, teen to 20s. Hard to say the exact age. So we don't know all the details, what she knew of what Eleazar looked like or what his appearance was. So when she makes this decision and sees this man who's in need, for all practical purposes, he is a stranger to her. By outside appearance, without having spoken to him to identify himself, when she's being asked for water, he's a stranger to her. So I have a question for you then. If a stranger comes up to you and asks for help, that's your measurement tool. How do you conduct yourself with the stranger? Now, mind you, this stranger, he isn't alone. There are men with him. He's got a group of men with him, probably no women amongst their group. That travel distance is not like they have their wives with them. It was just men alone. They have weapons because they're a caravan. They're traveling along camels. They're going to have to defend themselves. They have tools. They are strangers to her by the nature of her not having known them ahead of time. Even if she knew of their names or identified that they may exist, not necessarily know who they are, these gentlemen were, unless they actually say, I'm so-and-so. But that's the point where the man asks, may I have water? And that's where our conduct shows up. All right, the character trait. How do you treat a stranger? And what does God, if you've read the Torah, he says, remember you were strangers. So treat the stranger a particular way. Now, the stranger, why is that so important to God? What is the stranger? What was that? Feels his heart? Possibly. Keep in mind, God is the one who knows every one of us, right? But what was Abraham to the Canaanites when Abraham first arrived? A stranger. So how would God want the Canaanites, whether they were good or bad people, it didn't make a difference, to treat Abraham? They would want him, so he would want them to treat Abraham well. Now, when Abraham went into Egypt, what was he? A stranger to Egypt. But what happened in Egypt, regardless of the lie regarding his Sarah and his wife, what happened in Egypt? How did Egypt ultimately treat Abraham? Very well. Now, what about also with the Philistine king Abimelech? Regardless of the lie regarding Sarah, what was the final outcome? How was he treated? Well, yeah, he became very, very wealthy. Now, we're going to learn how they treat Isaac. Isn't so well, but they know Isaac. They're not so thrilled anymore. But that's later on in the Torah portion. So the objective of God when it comes to you, a stranger comes to you, we don't know who they are, but if we assume, it's a big assumption, that God has sent this person to me, how do I treat them?
Like
you'd like to be treated. If you were a stranger in another land, you don't know anything about it, right? So the nature of the character trait that Rebecca is reflecting is one of generosity, of kindness, respectfulness, but to a complete, for all practical purposes, stranger. So now it's the next question, which contrasts the woman at the well that Messiah runs across with a similar problem. Did she expect anything in return? Let's go to Messiah's story. Let's go to Messiah's story. So this is recorded in John. Let me find the book of John. Tell me somewhere. So John, Messiah runs across, now he's not looking for a wife, of course, but he runs across a character that he's going to meet, interact with, and he's going to ask a similar question. Note, the response he gets from her is quite different than how Rebecca responds to Eleazar. Very different in how they responded. Now note, Eleazar was looking for a particular character trait that he was seeking, not through her religious belief, not through her conduct of idol worship, but how she treated someone she knew nothing about. Other than she could observe from the outside, he clearly appeared wealthy. Other than that, you could see from the outside he appeared wealthy. Beyond that, she would not necessarily know unless she asks, "Who are you?" So, John chapter 4 discusses, we jump down to Messiah, he did a bunch of stuff. He's wandering around, right? He goes through Samaria, verse 5. It says, he came to sit in Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there, and Jesus entered, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat at the other well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman of Samaria came to draw water, and Jesus said, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. The woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." Jesus answered and said, "If you knew the gift of God and who it was who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." Stop there for a minute of the story. Now, in that story, what was he asking for? A drink of water. But what character trait do we learn that reflects when Eliezer asked Rebecca? What character trait was Rebecca showing? Kindness to a stranger. Just offered here. What character trait was this woman showing? Distrust of a stranger. This, you could argue how strange she obviously identified him being Jew from, I assume, his appearance. So distrust of him. How is it you're having dealings with me? So even though Rebecca could have done similarly, these men who come, "Who are you?" She didn't ask, "Who are you? And why are you asking me?" She responded and offered. It's two different types of people being taught to us or shown to us in these stories. Now, in this case, the Samaritan woman, then, once she learns a little bit about him, says at verse 11, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get the living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons, his livestock?" Jesus answered to her, "Whoever drinks this water will thirst again. Whoever drinks the water that I shall give him will never thirst, but the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." The man answered him and said, "Sir, give me some of this water that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw." Jesus said to her, "Go and call your husband and come here." Of course, the answer said, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You have spoken well. I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly." Stop there for a minute. So now the woman has inquired some details, and she received answers she was not expecting. And she has a bit of information about the nature of this individual. She now draws a conclusion. Now, she still has not given him water yet. She hasn't given him water yet. She's still asking. She's still inquiring. "I'm not giving this up to you until you answer my questions." And then she draws a conclusion. And she says, "Sir, I perceive you are a prophet." Now she has an identity she placed upon this individual. Now she will interact with him as a regular interaction. "Our fathers worship this mountain, and you Jews say that Jerusalem is the place to worship, where one ought to worship." Of course, I reply to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for our salvation is of the Jews. The hour is coming and now is. The true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. The Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit. Those who worship must be worship in spirit." The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming," it's called the Christ. "When he comes, he will tell us these things." Sorry, tell us all things. Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." Now she still hasn't given him water yet. They're still talking. But you notice now she has an identity to him. And she knows the power he has and the gifts he can give. Then she responds. Note, that is not the reaction that Rebecca gave, was it? She expected nothing in return, but she responded anyway. This one will not respond until she knows what she's getting in return. Whether she planned that or not, I can't argue that. But she learned what she was going to get, everlasting life. That was the deal. That could exist, but she had the individual to give that. And of course, now I'll respond to you. Of course, then she takes off and goes, tells everybody what's going on. It spreads the message and all that kind of good stuff, yada, yada, yada. But don't go into the details of how our conduct is after that. It doesn't really matter. The point is, we have two different women, two different contrasts of what we can compare, the nature, the character that God's contrasting. Which one of these two responses, Rebecca's response and the world's response, is actually being sought after? Which one is God actually looking for? Yeah. Think about that for a minute. Which one's God asking for? What kind of person? What if she'd responded, "Here, sir, have some water"? It'd have been different, wouldn't it? The interaction would have been different. It'd have been more similar to Rebecca's interaction. "Here, have some water." There's a character trait that wants to look at very closely these two women, their responses. There is one who, having very limited knowledge of the outside appearance, and both of them, mind you, only had the outside appearance to start with. Both went to the well, only had Messiah's outside appearance to look at, identifying as a Jew. Rebecca, the outside appearance, identifying as he's wealthy. Not much else to identify, because mind you, Eliezer's from Damascus. He doesn't look like the people that she is. He looks like the Canaanite people do. So that's the general appearance from his skin color or whatever his facial characteristics were, and possibly even his clothing too. And that's where he's from. So outside appearance alone, two completely different reactions. Anne, your hand was up.
Well, Rebecca's response was more like childlike, naive. I mean, you know, I would think, we would think that way, being experienced women or whatever, you know, not to, you know, just do it. This man with all these troops behind him. I mean, they had weapons. And I don't know. Maybe it's just, you know, we have stranger danger written inside ourselves now at this point. We don't have that naivety or that childlike behavior that would just give him what he needs, the water.
Mm-hmm. There is a sense of fear or apprehension. I would argue that in that exact tone, that thread of thought, there's a sense of trust that one has versus the other one, a sort of sense of distrust that one has. And that is infrequently a childlike behavior we characterize as children as far as the blind trust or simple trust. They are very different in nature. Yes, Jared.
Or there is the possibility of, "Here's some water, please don't hurt me."
You could argue it that way, as far as you could have opted for that choice. I would argue that since we have a character trait that Abraham was looking for in a wife for Isaac, and Eliezer, of course, sought the same character's trait, the promise that she received from that trust that she gave to a stranger who she knew nothing about, what did that gain Rebecca? A completely different life. Radically different than what she was living with. And mind you, Laban is her brother. Don't forget the kind of nature this guy has. We will learn more about him later on. The nature of the underhandedness within sight him is very strong. That's her brother, her older brother. Presumably older. In other ways, her brother. So she's going to leave that life of idol worship and dominance with regards to underhandedness and change her future, her whole family tree, so to speak, to a whole completely different life over here with people she's never really met. Now, she may know of them, but she's never actually met. There's no record of Abraham ever leaving to going visited on a family trips or family reunions. So as far as we know, he's over there. She stayed over there. So she's making this risk that she's willing to take on this nature. Yes.
I'm going to say this. If I went to another place and I'm in the position I am, I'm a single person, which I am. And if I went to another country and that happened to me, I would know who I would be, like a radar to him and saying, "I'm getting out of this place. I'm moving up and moving out."
possibly. Now we don't know anything beyond, we don't know what beyond what the Torah, what the Tanakh tells us, what the explanation is in our thoughts. But we're trying to understand the nature of these characters. So we have that one received a great benefit. Rebecca received a great benefit, and her whole family line was changed. Of course, obviously, she has, gives birth, has sons. They expand. Of course, we have today the massive descendancy that came from Abraham and through Jacob, and of course to Ishmael, to, or sorry, to Esau as well. But dominantly through that, through those lines, which we were, which most of the people in the world today are somehow related in various forms. So we have these dominant ways, and that's the blessing she received—a very different life than what she had staying with her father's household, Nahor, her grandfather's household. Now the other one, Now Messiah didn't say now she gets this great life in the city, this great benefit from anything that she did. The Messiah, there's no record of him of him saying here have all this great new life. Now we have record of her believing. So the life she's the woman the well was receiving was different than the one Rebecca was going to receive, in the form of belief. A future life that would somehow change. Things would change. So we still have a benefit to both women, but one responded with a quick trust, and one responded with a hesitancy, a fear, a distrust. Two different responses, two different results. Now, that isn't evil or bad, just two different results. Yes?
Well, you can see in a certain way that she has what Abraham had, this instinctive trust in God that made him able to pass, you know, cross over, and that she had that. Mm-hmm. That's what showed up in that interaction.
That faith. As God said, God attributed Abraham's actions as faith, righteousness, his faith as righteousness. She had the same within inside of her, did the same thing, which is a very unique characteristic trait. Hence, no one in Canaan had it. Find somebody who does. It's a rare trait. She had that with her. God told Abraham, go. Abraham went. God didn't tell him where he's going. Just go. Well, in Rebecca's case, she set a destination. Go, and she went. So that same character trait is still very strong, was strong both these two individuals who Abraham was, who Isaac was going to marry, Abraham wanted. Yes.
So I'm thinking that since Eliezer had a week to plan this out, and then he's praying about this whole situation, and the timing is just so perfect. Do you think it was God's spirit that was influencing her maybe to react in such a way? And does that happen as well?
There's a component what the Torah gives you. Now note, he says the women are coming out. They all look different ways. This person, that person, they all look different. All the girls coming out to get the water. But there's something that caught his attention. That one popped out. He happened to look at that time and decided it was beautiful. Now, beauty we know is the eye of the beholder. So which one do you think the angel of the Lord said, you like that one? Who brought your attention to it? So it would have been a dual thing. But note the nature of the individual who God selected, but also whose eye was looking. All God had to do is say, no, look over there instead. But he didn't. Eliezer looked that way, and that's when God said, you think that one's pretty. Go ask her. She could not have been pretty. Who knows? But you think she is because I'm telling you, you think so. Therefore, you will act this way to choose. So God can decide in that instant which one to select. Who knows what she actually truly looked like? I don't know. The Bible records her very commonly. She was very attractive, so I'm guessing she probably was. But the point is, that's when God said, look at this one. Notice this one. He could have chosen any one of them for Eliezer to spot. They chose that one for a new spot. So it's both a dual thing in that God selected this one at the right time. Eliezer made his prayer, but then God drew his attention to that particular lady. Plans. okay, now I don't have enough time to cover all of the other things I want to discuss today, so I apologize, but we'll cover a few more things. So we compared these two individuals, we compared the nature of Rebecca, we need nature of the one at the well, and the type of characters, traits that are being contrasted between these two. There's a few other things we want to rattle off or note, I should say, in this story. Well, I say in this story, there's the Haftor portion, which we didn't read yet. It's in 1 Kings. Now, note, there's a character trait that we learn from Abraham in this story. What's the character trait we're learning from Abraham? What is his concern? What's his fear? What's his desire for his son? What is it he's asking from Eliezer? Hang on a minute. He's asking for a wife. Now, is Abraham going to live for forever? No. It says Abraham's old, advanced in years. He knows his ending life is coming up. It's about to end soon. Now, we don't know when. Abraham, we could argue what day or year it was. But Abraham knows he's going to end. What's his concern then at the end of his life? What's your concern at the end of your life? Yeah, your descendancy. What's going to happen after you? What blessings can you give? What benefit, what extension of what you have learned and tried to teach, how will that grow after you? What will happen? So Abraham is concerned not by his own life, but what's going to occur. He is focused on the future generation. Now that was a character trait that God has said about Abraham that was unique and he liked it. That Abraham was going to teach his children and his grandchildren about me. That was God's comment, why he selected Abraham. Because Abraham was concerned not just by his own life, but by many generations down the road life. It was a descendancy for a long period of time. That was Abraham's focus. And God would say, that's the kind of focus I want. Focus on that character for Abraham that God was after. God blessed him for it. So we learned that already. We already know about Abraham. And this, of course, just example gives an example of Abraham focusing this event. What's going to happen after him? And what was his goal? Someone who would teach the character traits, the knowledge of God, and have the character traits to do so, to spread those out. Now, the Haftorah portion was selected for the same purpose. I didn't select it. Somebody, whoever, hundreds or thousands of years ago, selected it. It's in 1 Kings. It is a similar type of scenario because it shows us a character trait that is similar to what we've learned from an Abraham. Now, not identical, but similar. This is 1 Kings chapter 1. It's not identical to Abraham, but it's similar. Now, if we really look at very closely our Tanakh, we would see, quite obvious, that David is the most talked about individual in the whole Bible. There are books about him. What he wrote, what he lived from a childhood, the things that happened. He's talked about more about his life. We know more about his life than Messiah himself. We ask ourselves, why would God do that? Why would God want us to learn more about King David than even our own Messiah? Because there's something about King David God wants us to understand. He is a key character that God teaches us with. So this is toward the end, this near the end of David's life, this 1 Kings, regarding David. It says, verse 1. Now King David was old, advanced in years, and they put covers upon him, but he could not get warm. Therefore his servant said to him, let a young one, a virgin, be sought for our Lord the king. Let her stand before the king, and let her care for him, and let her lie in your bosom, that our Lord the king may be warm. So they sought for a lovely young woman throughout all the territory of Israel, and found Abishag the Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The young woman was very lovely, and she cared for the king, and served him, but the king did not know her. Of course, he obviously didn't have any relations with her. Now, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. He prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. His father had not rebuked him at any time by saying, why have you done so? He was also a very good-looking man. His mother had borne him after Absalom. He conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, with Abiathar the priest, and they followed and helped Adonijah. But Zadok the priest, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Rei, and the mighty men who belonged to David were not with Adonijah. And Adonijah sacrificed sheep and oxen and fatted calf at the stone of Zelet, which is by Enrogel. He also invited his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants, but he did not invite Nathan the prophet, Benaiah, the mighty man, nor Solomon, his brother. Stop there for a minute. So we have a story that we have of an old man, David, the most recorded, if not the most recorded person in the entire Bible. When I say that, I'm including the Psalms he wrote. I'm including, obviously, his personal story, and, of course, all the references to him regarding the nature of him throughout all of his successive king descendants who all, he was like David or was not like David, that kind of thing. All examples we have of David's character nature. So I use the term very specifically for David on purpose. So very old. What's going on while he's old? Now, mind you, those of you who don't recall David's history, he's had multiple sons. A few of them have died. Some were murdered. Some were killed because of David's conduct. Now, what I mean is that David's nature, was it always a good one? No. He did bad things. But there's something unique about King David, is that when he did bad things, what did he then do about them? He repented and went back to God. Now, that is a character trait we see repeated in his story over and over again. Regardless how awful the conduct he did, he still goes back to God and says, God, forgive me. I crossed the line yet again. Now, I say that because he doesn't stay good. He goes back, makes a mistake again, then comes back. It's a cycle. We learn about King David. Hence, why I think God has him the most recorded person in your Bible to learn the cycle for us. No matter what happens, always remember, go back. Go back. Doesn't matter how bad it. We're talking murder. We're talking adultery. There's a lot of things which we ourselves have never done. But even those levels still go back. So the nature of this man, it's important to know the nature of what God's teaching us about him. So of course, now in this story, of course, we have he's lost some sons at different times. Adonijah, of course, has raised himself up as the next king, which is the logical choice. He's the guy in line. You'd have Absalom, of course, being first, and Adonijah his next brother. Solomon, of course, being the youngest, would not be included amongst the line of the kings. He was too young. But the king, David, did not rebuke him at all. See, Nathan spoke to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, saying, have you not heard Adonijah, this is verse 11, the son of Haggith has become king, and David our Lord does not know it. Come, please let me now give you counsel that you may save your own life and the life of your son, Solomon. So what does the prophet understand? The prophet understands once Adonijah becomes king, what's he going to do? Execute Solomon and Bathsheba. Well, why would he do that? He's not going to kill his other brothers, though, is he? No, just us two. Why? Because as long as there's someone who can dispute your kingdom, your kingship, get rid of them. When there's no one to dispute it, then you become officially king. Now, there's something I want to point out to you. If I go around, this is me, just me, Daniel, saying, I'm king, and then everybody else agrees with it, what happens? I'm king. Simple as that. If I go around saying, I'm president, and everybody agrees with it, guess what? I'm president. So as long as the people's opinion holds strong to any individual, that individual becomes what they're asking to become. So if David does not rebuke Adonijah, saying, you can't do this, eventually he will be king. Enough people will agree, okay, accept it, he's king. Now, we point out that there are certain things that are with him. It points out he conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah. Now, Joab was the commander of David's army. So, Adonijah has the army on his side, right? He also has, of course, Abiathar the priest. He has the priesthood on his side. So, a man who has the army with him and the priesthood with him is now declaring king, and everybody's saying, okay, he's king. But there's a character missing. Who's missing? David's missing. David's promise is missing. Nathan was a prophet. So even though Nathan is also missing, even though he has the priesthood on Adonijah's side, he does not have the prophet on Adonijah's side. Who's a prophet represent? Yeah, he's God. He's God's words. Now, the priest is conduct, but prophets the words of God. So God is not on his side. The prophet isn't, so God isn't. So though he has the major components that matter to humans, he doesn't have the component that matters to God. He doesn't have God with him. So that's the nature of Adonijah. So, of course, he excludes these individuals. And, of course, obviously Bathsheba and, of course, her son are going to become dead if they don't do something about it. Verse 13 says, "Go immediately to King David and say to him, did you not, my lord king, swear by to your maidservant, saying, 'Assuredly your son Solomon shall reign after me, and then shall sit on my throne, why does Adonijah should become king?' Then while you're still talking there with the king, I will also come and after you and confirm your words." So Bathsheba went to the chamber of the king. Now the king was very old, and Abishag the Shunammite was serving the king. Bathsheba bowed and did homage to the king, and the king said, "What is your wish?" He said, "My lord, you swore by Jehovah your God to your maidservant, saying, 'Assuredly Solomon your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne.'" Stop there for a minute. Note, David knows the Torah very, very, very well. When you swear something in the name of God, what does that mean? Can you ever undo it? No. Even if it means your death? Yes. You swore an oath by God's name. God, the Torah says, you swear by name, men in particular, you swear by name. There is no way you're allowed to undo it, even if it means your own death. There isn't an option. That's not given. So God does not allow his name to be used haphazardly. In vain. Make it useless. Right? So, of course, she's reminding him, you swore in the name of God this would happen. Verse 18, "Now look, Adonijah has become king, and now my lord the king, you do not know about it. He has sacrificed oxen and fatted cattle and sheep in abundances, invited all the sons of the king, Abiathar the priest, and Joab the commander of the army, but Solomon your servant he has not invited. As for you, my lord, O king, the eyes of all Israel upon you, that you should tell them who will sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Otherwise it will happen when my lord the king rests with his fathers that I and my son Solomon will be counted as sinners." If you're in the king's presence and you're counted as a sinner, what's the king do to you? You're now no longer in his presence alive anymore. You become a dead person in his presence. Just then, while she was still talking with the king, Nathan the prophet also came in. So they told the king, saying, "Here is Nathan the prophet." And when he came in before the king, he bowed down before the king with his face to ground. Verse 24 says, Nathan said, "My lord, O king, have you said Adonijah should reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne? For he has gone down today, has sacrificed oxen, fatted cattle, and sheep in abundance, and has invited all the king's sons, the commanders of the army, and Abiathar the priest, and look, they are eating and drinking before him, and they said, 'Long live King Adonijah.' But he has not invited me, even me your servant, nor Zadok the priest, nor Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, but nor your servant Solomon. Has this thing been done by my lord the king, and you've not told your servant who should sit on the throne of my lord the king after him?" Stop there for a minute. So, note the men who Nathan listed. Himself, Zadok, the other priest. Now, this is a unique time in the history of our Bibles where there are two duplicate priesthoods actively operating. Zadok and Abiathar. Now, this occurred because of Eli's conduct and his sons, and God said, "I'm going to erase you." Both of them, now they've been conducting as dual priests throughout all of David's life. They've been dual priesthoods. You could use one or the other. It's a dual priesthood existence right now. One, Abiathar, is the priest of rightful by age, meaning the right genealogy and of age. Zadok is the right one based the promise God gave with the death of Eli and to Samuel. So we have two different priests. Both are conducting their conduct, whatever it all what all involved. But Abiathar is the one who his priesthood joins the rebels, so to speak, Adonijah. And Zadok was not invited. So Zadok, the other priesthood, is not with Adonijah. He's with, or grouped together with, Solomon. So we have dual priests, we have dual kings. We have an argument of Solomon and Adonijah. There's actually two entire cultures dividing here, between Solomon and the other gentleman, the commander of the army, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada. He's the commander of the other half of the army. So even Joab, who is the commander of one half, Benaiah is the commander of the other half, you even have the army divided into two groups. Now, Benaiah's technique, his part that he ruled were the archers and slingers. That was his division of the army that he controlled. The bows and arrows and the slingers, that was his job, not the swordsmen, which Joab ruled. So you have the armies divided, the kingdoms being divided, the priesthoods being divided into two completely different families or two different lines happening here, while David is still alive. Because that's key one. King David, verse 28, and said, call Bathsheba to me. So she came to the king's presence, stood before the king. The king took an oath, said, as Jehovah lives, so has who has redeemed my life from every distress. Note, stop for a minute. Even David points out, everything I've done, even though I was wrong many times, God still redeemed my life. So David's acknowledging, even though my screw-ups, God still redeemed me. Verse 30, just as I swore to you by Jehovah, God of Israel, saying, as surely Solomon your son shall be king after me, and he shall sit on my throne in my place, so I certainly will do this day. But she, of course, bowed with her face to the earth and did homage to the king and said, let my lord the king live forever. And of course, then David of course, called Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, that came before the king. He told the same thing, take your servants to the Lord, and have Solomon my son ride on a mule. Now, I could compare and contrast these two kings. I don't have time to do that. But you actually have an explanation within these two kings and their conduct. There's just one chapter alone of Messiah being recorded out and Hasatan being recorded out. The events are paralleled throughout both these men, these two kings. One takes everything, it looks the same as the other, except one has the promise of the king, the sworn oath, and the prophet with him. Other than that, they both look identical. So what would that tell us about Hasatan? Now, I don't have time to record all of them. I'm out of time already. That he should, in appearance, look just like the right king. But what will he be missing? Only the promise from God and the prophet, which means God's action. Promise to the king and the prophet with him. The only two things he will be missing. Everything else he'll have with him. So it's important to note that this is a learning. I don't have time to go through it in great detail, which I'd like to, but I'm just out of time today. But if you look at these two, and just compare and contrast each of the stories, individual characters of all of them. One is a show, looks like a king, and one actually is a king. And you'll note the distinct differences. One of the main characteristics, Adonijah, all of his followers run before him. All of Solomon's followers come after him. They're behind him. The nature of these two kings. We understand, okay, the rightful king, what will his followers be? Will they be leading him or will they be following him? So rightful king, one follows, does not lead. An unrightful king is led, is not followed. Does it make a difference? So understand these two natures, these two kings. We have a chance to run through 1 Kings chapter 1. It's important to distinguish these differences, these characters or traits. So when we learn from David, David was concerned about what was going to happen after him. Hence, he said, Solomon is the right king. Make this happen. He instructs how it's going to occur. And he instructs them, they follow Solomon. They follow the instruction that David set, right? It's important to note. While the others follow the instruction of what Adonijah set. To compare and contrast these two, when you get the opportunity to understand the nature of what you would expect to see, when you have the man of perdition, the one who is supposed to come as far as Hasatan or the one who's influenced by him, the nature of those who follow versus those who lead is a character trait that we see with these two men here. Contrast that, the same character trait of Rebecca and the woman at the well. The nature of trust and say, here, have some water. Or, no, who are you? Distrust. So you have the character traits of what a king will look like, the people who are around him, who are honoring the God's words, what they will look like, and the character trait of the nature of what God values in how you respond to a stranger. So these character traits are combined into these individual stories to understand the nature of the people that follow God versus the nature of people who follow men. Yes.
I was just thinking, it's frightening to think about how many people will follow the Antichrist, because he's going to look just like this.
He'll look like it. He'll look right.
He's going to look just like this king that wants to rule.
And he sounds right, too.
And
Elijah sounds right, too. So his words make sense.
He'll be a chicken in every pot, and he'll pay your medical bills. It's all going to look really good. And it's frightening to think about how many people will follow the Antichrist and lose their life.
But if their character trait inside them is good, well, they follow. They'll know this isn't right. This doesn't sound, this doesn't ring true with the promises God gave and the nature of character this person's going to reflect and how they will conduct themselves. Not many will see. I get that. Check his hands. Any other questions or comments? I'm out of time, so I apologize for taking you guys over time. I'd like to go through this some other time later, but it is what it is. Any questions or comments? We'll conclude with a prayer then. Almighty God, our great Father, thank you for our Shabbat, our day of rest, our time to worship and to study and to learn what is fair and just in your eyes. Father, help us to be the people you wish for us to be, the servants that serve and understand and are kind and generous and patient. Father, help us to be like you are. We trust you and ask your blessing throughout the rest of our service, Father, just for our day, that is. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info.